Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also newly the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And on this episode, we're celebrating Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day!
Woo! Yay!
And we're celebrating it by working really hard because we have a lot of interviews this week, Tracy.
That's right. We have a ton. We start out with my friend Steve Kreisberg over at AFSCME. He's the director of collective bargaining there. And we have a great conversation about the importance of public sector unions as well as some recent attacks on unions and workers broadly.
You had another really interesting interview this week too, didn't you, Tracy?
Yes, I also spoke to Saka Bhatti. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's also the director of the Refund America Project, and he wrote a couple pieces for In These Times. His most recent one is about comparisons people are making between Chicago and Detroit, and he sets the record straight about why Chicago won't go bankrupt.
Well, you're not the only one who had interesting conversations.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been working hard as well. Tell me what you've been doing.
I spoke with Terrence McCoy. He is the poverty and social justice reporter for the Washington Post. And Terry actually broke the story just last week of companies profiting to the tune of millions of dollars from the suffering of low-income individuals in Baltimore who had been hard hit by lead poisoning. So we have a really awful and yet really fascinating conversation.
Important interview.
Yeah, his really important investigative reporting. Also spoke with Clara Miller. She's the president of the F.B. Heron Foundation. And we have a really interesting conversation about the role of philanthropy in the new economy.
Well, I'm excited that we have a full episode with lots of great interviews.
We do indeed. So let's get started.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. On today's episode, we're celebrating Labor Day, a holiday recognizing the American labor movement and achievements of American workers. I'm joined by Steve Kreisberg, Director of Collective Bargaining for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, better known as AFSCME. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks, Tracy. Appreciate you having me.
So there are a lot of misperceptions about labor unions. You know, can you explain what are the benefits of belonging to a union?
Well, there's many benefits. I think it's fairly well known and well documented that people who work in union workplaces tend to make more money, tend to have better benefits. I mean, those can be quantified pretty easily. 20 to 30% higher wages. They're more likely to have pension plans. They're more likely to have comprehensive health benefits. But what's not realized as much is that people in union contracts, unions actually play a significant role in decreasing inequality in our society. And that's inequality between women and men's wages. So it reduces inequality between women and men. It reduces inequality between white and minority workers, so it closes that racial income gap between whites, Hispanics, Asians, and African Americans. So there's a very positive influence overall, both on individual workers, but also on our economic life as a whole.
And yet there are many conservatives who will point to some of the benefits that you mentioned, such as pensions, as a reason for state budget deficits. And that's why, you see a lot of conservative politicians trying to rein in public sector worker benefits. How would you respond to these arguments?
Well, pensions are not the reasons for state budget deficits. The state budget deficits are really not a complicated matter. Most states have cut taxes to an excessive degree. We have employed a misguided trickle-down theory of economics over the last 10 years in many of our states. So we have conservative politicians who buy into this, what they would call supply-side theory. But really what it's about is a belief that if you cut taxes for the wealthy, and you cut taxes for corporations, they will then produce more things and you'd have greater economic output. But the reverse is true. We need greater demand in our economy. And what happened in the Great Recession was we lost a whole lot of demand. In other words, people didn't have money to buy things. So it doesn't matter how much cheaper it is for a company to produce a product. If people don't have money to buy that product, they're still not going to buy it. So the profitability of corporations is not in jeopardy. Corporate America has got greater levels of profits now than they've ever had. The problem is the American worker has less money than they've had in real terms in over 40 years. So we need policies that focus on demand. And that's just a fancy way of saying we've got to raise the incomes of people. And you don't raise the incomes of people by slashing state budgets and reducing taxation on the wealthy. To the extent that we have pension problems in state budgets, that's simply a manifestation of the fact that a number of governors over a period of two decades have cut taxes and avoided making pension payments. And that was a direct trade-off. The best example would be Governor Christy Whitman in New Jersey, who in the late 90s specifically financed a tax cut for the wealthiest residents of New Jersey on the basis of not making pension payments. That pattern had been repeated not as directly, but implicitly in a number of other states. Places like Illinois and Pennsylvania are most notorious among them.
And so you mentioned Illinois, and that's where Governor Rauner is trying to weaken public sector unions. Can you break down for us what exactly is happening there?
Well, he's not just trying to weaken public sector unions. He's trying to bust public sector unions. I mean, there's no nice way to say this. He has somehow gotten in his mind that unions are the most evil thing in society and that we need to be obliterated, which is ironic. At a point in our history where unions have been declining and we represent less of the workforce than ever, now is the time that folks think we're the greatest danger. And really what we're putting in jeopardy for people like Governor Rauner is their political power. Rauner is a venture capitalist, hedge fund manager guy, has made a lot of money. Incidentally, making a lot of money by investing pension fund money, which he doesn't talk about a lot. But Governor Rauner is a very wealthy individual, and he's consolidated his economic power, and now they want to consolidate their political power. And unions and organized labor and progressive allies are really the only organized opposition left. So when you have the Koch brothers, who have very publicly stated that they intend to spend close to $1 billion in the 2016 elections, there has to be, we believe, a counterbalance to that. Organized labor is that counterbalance. But the folks on the other side, the Koch brothers and those who support them and think like them, are very strategic, they're smart people, and so what they're aimed is to try to weaken us. And so what Rauner is doing is essentially trying to wipe out the organized opposition, a piece of it at least, and that's organized labor. If we look at what state workers in Illinois make, they don't make an extremely large amount of money. The average wage for a state worker in Illinois is less than $50,000 a year. When they retire and get a pension, it's about $20,000, $25,000 a year in retirement. This is not a lot of money. No one is getting wealthy as a state employee in Illinois. But yet, we see these relentless attacks, and oftentimes the people financing the attacks and making the attacks are millionaires and billionaires and are somehow thinking that somebody who makes $50,000 a year as an employee and $25,000 a year as a retiree is getting too much. It's really hard to square that point of view with reality.
And shifting to another state, I think one of the more notorious battles between a governor and public sector unions was between Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, who kind of, I think, set the stage for empowering conservatives to really dismantle unions. What has happened in states like Wisconsin where collective bargaining rights have dramatically weakened?
Well, nothing good has happened in Wisconsin, and I think you could compare Wisconsin with its neighbor, Minnesota. And you have, Governor Walker and the Wisconsin legislature, which is quite conservative, adopting, again, the supply-side trickle-down economic theory. Their belief is that if we cut the wages of workers and we provide corporations in the state with significant tax advantages and cut their taxes, we'll have economic growth. And so they deployed that theory, and they've had one of the slowest growing economies in the nation. So let's go to their neighbor, Minnesota, where Governor Dayton took on a little bit more of a progressive policy. And Governor Dayton said, no, what we're going to do here to address our budget deficits, because all state governments were knocked on their back during the Great Recession when tax revenues declined significantly by almost 25% in some states. He says, what we're going to try to do is enact some tax increases that will be progressive in nature. So what we want to do here in Minnesota is increase taxes for those who can afford to pay, with the idea of we're just going to maintain our public sector and we're going to maintain our services. We're not going to cut them. We're not going to grow them, but we're going to maintain them, because that workforce will create demand in our economy. They will go out to stores and purchase goods and services. And so you have one theory in Wisconsin and another theory in Minnesota, and Minnesota's had very rapid recovery from the Great Recession, has a more robust economy, has greater income growth, and greater employment growth. So here we have two different states side by side with two different economic theories being put in place. One has been successful, one has been an abject failure. So it's pretty clear that Governor Walker's been a failure. And the fact that he wants to bring those kinds of policies as president is a different issue and a different discussion. But the policy choices of trickle-down and supply side are really a mistake. They're a mistake in this country, and they're a mistake in Europe, where we also see the same kind of austerity measures being implemented. They actually retard economic growth, and they really take its toll on workers and those who really, you know, work for a living instead of invest for a living.
And you mentioned the Koch brothers and other powerful forces that, you know, are influencing political campaigns. But so how would you respond to claims that, you know, public sector unions are manipulating the political process and are, you know, securing unsustainable gains for themselves, that they're wielding political influence that they shouldn't be allowed to weigh?
Well, you know, that's an allegation, but there's no evidence that it's true. Okay, the unions are not spending $900 million in an election campaign. What we see, again, if you look at the average AFSCME member, for instance, and we're the largest public sector union, our average member makes $45,000 a year. When they retire, their average pension is about $20,000 a year. They have health benefits. This is not the stuff of unsustainable economic gains. This is just ordinary American workers making a living wage and trying to get by, trying to send their kids to school, trying to lead a decent life. I'm not sure what our critics would like to see. Do they want public workers to make $30,000 a year without health benefits and without retirement benefits? I mean, our members would gladly give up their health benefits if there was a promise that was enforceable that they'd never get sick. And they'd probably be willing to give up their retirement benefits if you could promise them they'd never get old. But in the absence of those kinds of promises, we need retirement benefits, we need health benefits, and we need a living wage. And I think we're gaining all of those through employment, by working, not as a gift. And the wages and compensation that public workers get is really quite modest. It's not unsustainable in any sense of the word.
Shifting gears just a bit, earlier this summer, the Supreme Court announced that it would actually hear the case of Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association, which would seek to eliminate fees that non-members pay to unions, since the unions still bargain on their behalf. You know, can you explain a bit more about what this case is and what the implications are?
Yeah, this case is really about silencing the voices of workers. It's about limiting and restricting the ability of workers to join together to argue for a better wage and for a better economic life. So it's part and parcel of what I just discussed. It's part and parcel of our critics' efforts to reduce compensation for workers. And if the Supreme Court does silence the voices of workers, the results are fairly predictable. Workers will get less. Their wages will be reduced, if not in nominal terms, meaning if not actually reduced, they won't keep up with inflation, which we have not been keeping up with anyway. And our health benefits will be eroded. and we're likely to lose our pensions over time as well. That is the agenda. The agenda is to silence our voices and make workers' voices unheard. So our interests go unaddressed.
So are you concerned at all that the Supreme Court decided to hear this case? Because it seems like there is precedent that would settle that you know, workers who aren't part of the labor union are being represented. So are you concerned about the implications of them merely hearing the case?
Well, of course. I think if you look at the case, the Friedrichs case, about 40 years ago, the Supreme Court decided this identical issue. And in a 9-0 decision, 9-0, the Supreme Court at that time ruled that the way we do things today is authorized, it's legal, it's appropriate, and it's constitutional. So here we have a radical Supreme Court that has decided that they will rehear that case. And the only reason you would rehear a 9-0 verdict is if you want to reconsider that verdict and change it. We see no basis for the change other than the fact that we have a very highly political, very partisan Supreme Court, and that they've been activists in trying to change the rules of our society and really trying to tilt the political playing field in favor of those who have money and the wealthy. They did it with the Citizens United case. They did it with a few other cases related to voting rights. And this is yet another example of how they are essentially rigging the rules so that wealthy corporate interests get greater representation at the expense of ordinary Americans.
As I mentioned at the top, we're celebrating Labor Day, a holiday that recognizes the American labor movement. And we've seen a surge in another kind of labor movement, the Fight for 15 campaign, which is led in large part by fast food workers demanding a $15 an hour wage, as well as the right to form a union. You know, from your perspective, do you feel like the Fight for 15 campaign really is going to, I guess, change how people think about labor unions? And how do you think the successes are going so far?
Well, I think it's been remarkably successful. And I think the Fight for 15 is not really about the unions. It's about the workers. You know, this is really about fast food workers and others who are on the low, who are in low wage jobs coming together and say, look, all work has dignity, and all workers deserve that dignity as well. And people who work should be able to support their families. And the $15 an hour minimum wage is really nothing that anybody's going to get wealthy on, but perhaps it's enough or to put people in a better position to create a better future for their kids. But if you're going to pay somebody $7.50 an hour or $8 an hour, that individual is not going to be able to sustain their family. So we need to have policies in this country where all work pays a living wage. And $15 an hour represents that. And what's powerful about this is workers are joining together to create this movement. And they're talking to each other, and they're making their voices heard in a collective way. Now, that is the essence of what a union does. That is the essence of collective bargaining. But this effort is not a union effort. This is a workers' effort. And the reason I say that is because people tend to separate the union from the worker. We don't, but other people do. And I think really what we're seeing here is workers are joining together, and that is the essence of what a union is. And that's really where collectively they're creating their own power.
My guest is Steve Kreisberg, Director of Collective Bargaining for AFSCME. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This is Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. A months-long investigation by The Washington Post has uncovered the latest scam targeting low-income consumers. The story takes us to Baltimore, where a cottage industry has cropped up to make millions off of low-income black families suffering from lead poisoning. With me to discuss this is Terrence McCoy. He's poverty and social justice reporter for The Washington Post. He reported the story. Terrence, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
So can you first give us a quick overview of what's going on here? How are companies profiting from low-income individuals who have been hit by lead poisoning?
Well, it's something that's complicated and difficult to understand at first. So it's best just to think of it as there are two types of settlements. The first type of settlement, it's what's called just a regular settlement that we're all familiar with, that it's paid out as a lump sum for people. The second type of settlement is something referred to as a structured settlement. This settlement's different. It, as opposed to going out as one lump sum, it ekes out across month to month to month, across decades. And that is intended to help someone weather the stresses of their everyday life. And it's especially recommended for people who don't have a lot of experience managing large sums of money. They're vulnerable recipients, or they might just in some way have diminished capacity mentally.
So people who have been hit by lead poisoning via lead paint in old homes and substandard housing have ended up with structured settlements like you're describing to compensate them for the lead poisoning?
Yeah, I spoke to at least a half a dozen lawyers in the Baltimore area who litigate lead paint lawsuits. And they say virtually every single time they get a settlement, they recommend a structured settlement for those recipients. These recipients oftentimes, their stories follow a very similar narrative arc. They begin in these urban slum housing in Baltimore, either east or west, and they go from there, in which they suffer significant lead paint poisoning. And as we've talked about before, what that does is it means that someone has diminished capacity. I mean, these are the things that we saw all throughout the Freddie Gray protests. He was almost an archetypal case of a lead paint poisoning victim.
And he's actually one of the individuals you profile in your story. He was hit by lead poisoning. He suffered severe cognitive impairments as a result, and he actually ended up with one of these structured settlements?
Yeah, his life was a case study, as we've said before, in the effects of lead paint poisoning in poor Black communities. Mm-hmm. He was somebody who was raised in Sandtown, Winchester, inside a series of lead-painted tenements across that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just him, it was his siblings as well who suffered lead paint poisoning. According to the court documents, each of their lead levels was at least eight times the size of what the CDC recommends as elevated. So they had eight times what the CDC says is tolerable for somebody. And what that meant was all three of them, according to court records, ended up in sort of classes that were intended for special education, had difficulties in school. Freddie Gray had difficulties with learning. And these are characteristics that we see across lead paint poisoning victims.
So how are companies profiting off of these structured settlements and off of these families who have been hit by lead poisoning?
So what happens with these structured settlements is because it goes out over decades, this is an illiquid asset. Mm-hmm. It is something that somebody, once you decide to structure your settlement, you can't go back. You can't take backsies on this. This is something that you have that asset, and the only way to be able to capitalize on it is it gave rise to these sort of companies that say, you don't need to wait 500 months for that $500,000, $1,000 every month. I can give you 60 grand today. And you give me the rights to that $500,000. So that's what happens when you see these sort of situations where you have these sort of unequal numbers like that. Granted, that those payments are not worth $500,000 today because the present value is, of course, smaller than the aggregate or face value of those payments.
And so companies have been actually purchasing these structured settlements from individuals who over a lifetime might be expecting $500,000, say, in total payments, but they've been, as you reported, purchasing them for really dimes on the dollar.
Dimes on the dollar, at least according to one company that I profiled. I looked through 52 cases, 52 deals that they did, that they petitioned the court to be able to go through. And it revealed that they normally, on average, offer about 33 cents on the dollar, the present day dollar. And what you see from that is you see a lifetime of payments that someone could be expecting to receive then in exchange for a lump sum that is oftentimes significantly smaller than the aggregate value or the present day value of those payments.
And that might be a deal that someone might want to make, right? They might say, you know what, actually I have a large amount amount of debt, or I want to buy a house or something. And so maybe that lump sum that's much smaller might be something they might actually want. But you describe cases where, I mean, it's really actually quite heartbreaking to read. People were signing paperwork that they didn't even understand.
But I, at the same time, I think that's a point that we cannot run away from, is that this industry says that these are deals that people get money, get people money they need right now, as opposed to waiting all that time. Let's say you have, I mean, something that we can't run away from is the reality of the fact that disability, poverty is expensive. There are expenses that impoverished citizens incur that citizens of other socioeconomic statuses do not. And when you have those sort of situations, there are immediate crises that arise, medical expenses, whether you need to post bail for somebody, whether you need to make your rent, your mortgage payment, whatever it may be, that you need that money right now. And these companies say that these deals help people get the money that they wouldn't be able to get any other way.
Now, they say that, and that certainly seems to be the industry model, right? I mean, it's hard not to make a comparison to payday loans, right? You can see the need that it's trying to fill. And yet, the way that your story really profiles how this is playing out seems to be pretty abusive.
There's a difference, according to the research that I've gathered, there is a difference between the model idea of what this industry is versus how it can play out. Really, what's happening in this situation is that these companies are operating in something of a broken system inside Maryland. The Maryland Structured Settlement Protection Act is significantly weaker than other acts across the nation.
And that's a law that's on the books in Maryland that is intended to protect people with these kinds of structured
settlements. Exactly. There's nothing new about companies trying to make a buck or trying to profit off these sort of off structured settlements. There's nothing new. So what happened was in 2000, Maryland was one of the first states to pass something called a Protection Act. And what that act did was it decreed a series of restrictions that these companies have to go through in order for these deals to go through. One of them is that it has to get the approval of a court, approval of a judge. Another is that it needs to go through, the person selling these SIP payments need to be able to seek the counsel of what's called an independent professional advisor. And what this has shown, what my work has shown, is the fact that Maryland's Protection Act, it has weaknesses compared to other ones, because it was one of the first iterations of this act, and later iterations had tighter restrictions and stronger regulatory measures.
So you describe one of the ways that companies have found to get around this Protection Act is, it seems, contracting with, or maybe not contracting with, but always using the same attorney as that independent advisor. You profile a man named Charles E. Smith, who showed up as the independent advisor. Or I put large air quotes that one can't hear on radio, independent advisor in all 52 of the cases that you reviewed, which raises real questions about whether...
This is a situation where it gets murky. I mean, it's difficult to ascertain exactly what's going on. I can tell you that Charles E. Smith says that in every situation, the annuitants contact him. And the way that the law says is that the person operating in this capacity cannot have any sort of relationship with the company that is looking to purchase these rights. And Charles E. Smith says that he does not have any relationship with that company whatsoever. It's the annuitants that are contacting him. But I can tell you that I've reviewed 52 of those cases, and in every situation, every case, it was Charles E. Smith who was the independent professional advisor.
Well, and it makes you wonder, right? I mean, if he were to come back and say to this company, actually, I don't know that Rose, one of the people you profiled in the story, understood the paperwork that you sent her. I don't recommend that this go forward. Would he continue to get their business? It raises questions, right, about sort of what the incentives are.
I can tell you that critics say that what they call a conflict of interest with these sort of arrangements. If a lawyer is operating in this capacity on deal after deal, that in these deals also include these companies, critics say that definitely seems to be a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. So backing up just a little bit, you know, I have to say, and we've sort of towed around this a little bit, but it was. As a former legal aid lawyer, I'll disclose that as I'm about to ask this question, which you'll see why that's relevant. A a question I had while I was reading, and I'm sure that many readers had, as you noted, several of the people that you profile in your reporting have cognitive impairments due, in fact, to the lead poisoning that they were exposed to. Brain damage, intellectual disabilities, several are barely even able to read, right? They have actually family members who read their mail, and that's, in fact, in the case of Rose, how she even found out that she had sold her structured settlement to a third party. She didn't understand that that had happened. So a question I had while I was reading was whether the contracts that they signed and the decisions of the court would really hold up to further scrutiny. Has anyone said that they plan to challenge these petitions and these contracts on those grounds?
These contracts are difficult to challenge in court, considering that these, and this is something that is going to be litigated in Rose's lawsuit against Charles E. Smith, who is the man who advised her. And that's Charles E. Smith's earliest contestations is the fact that, listen, you signed these documents. You can't go back and say that was a mistake. You signed those documents. And when someone signs a document, the understanding is that you understand that document. So this is something that we're going to see played out over the next coming months and even years about whether or not this is something that people can go back and say, well, I didn't understand it. Well, the companies can then say, well, you signed it. I mean, what are we supposed to say? I mean, a lot of these companies would likely say something effective like, we're not doctors. How are we supposed to ascertain someone's cognitive abilities? If they're signing the document of their own free volition, is it our job to say, no, you can't do that? So this is something that is going to be possibly a coming situation we're going to see resolved maybe in the next coming months or years.
So as we commemorate Hurricane Katrina's 10th anniversary, there's been increasing attention paid to what's being called environmental racism. Some have described it as, quote, racism in the air we breathe. And really, due to nearly a century of entrenched structural racism, people of color are more likely to live and to work in environments that are toxic to their health. And lead poisoning from substandard housing is really a prime example. Now we see that companies are intentionally targeting people who have literally been poisoned by structural racism and injustice. Do you view this as related to the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think that's an interesting question. I think the Black Lives Matter movement can take upon environmental, as you said, environmentally racism, as you call it, as something that they can seize upon to be able to enlive in their movement. At the same time, I think what we see with the structured settlement scenario is this is the final chapter, in a way, of the Freddie Gray saga. When you think of where that narrative began in these sort of lead-painted tenements in some of the poorest communities in Baltimore, and what happened even before that, when you think about racially driven segregated housing policies in Baltimore that more or less put certain communities and kept them there and made it difficult for them to leave certain communities, that then in turn atrophied, and those then houses then gave rise to mass levels of lead poisoning. I mean, this is something, if you trace it all the way back to its origins, this can be perceived by some observers to say that this is racially driven in some ways.
And, you know, your story was, I think, timely in yet another way, which was that just a few weeks ago, we heard incredibly offensive and related remarks from the top Maryland housing official. He basically accused low-income mothers in Baltimore of intentionally poisoning their children with lead in order to get, quote, free housing. Now, this was something that sparked a level of outrage. There was something of an apology that followed. Some people were not necessarily satisfied by that apology. Do you see a real disconnect here between sort of top leadership in Maryland and what's going on in Baltimore?
I think there's a disconnect between communities that don't have to deal with this problem and communities that do. I know I get emails sometimes or comments in the stories where people say, well, listen, I grew up in a house that was built before 1958. There was lead paint in my house. I turned out to be fine. How is it that these people you're saying did not? And a lot of people are forgetting the fact that it's not the lead paint per se that specifically leads to lead paint poisoning. It's the atrophy inside those houses. Mm-hmm. It is the lead paint chipping. Mm-hmm. It is the structural degradation of those homes that leads to it. If you properly maintain every year, 2 years, you go back and you lacquer that paint up there, and it's not flaking off the onto the floor, and it's not covering bed sheets, and children aren't eating it up bits of it off the floor, you're not going to get the same levels of lead paint poisoning that people in those houses would. And when certain communities are living in houses that are under the yoke of what some call slumlords, or people who are disinterested in maintaining the structural integrity of those houses, that can lead to situations where people have lead paint poisoning.
Well, Terrence McCoy with the Washington Post, we really appreciate this very important reporting. We look forward to having you back, and we look forward to seeing you continue to chase this story with Rose and whatever the next chapter might be.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm joined by Saqib Bhatti, director of the Refund America Project and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. His latest article can be found in the publication In These Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So your piece is called Wall Street is Choking Our Cities, How They Can Fight Back Through Collective Bargaining. And in it, you discuss the steep fees that cities pay for various financial services, such as bonds. Can you walk us through what these steep fees exactly are and how they're impacting cities?
Sure. I mean, so cities end up taking out a wide array of financial deals to make payroll, to manage their investments, to take out loans or bonds. And in much the same way that individual people get hit with fees for banking, so do cities. Maybe with an individual person, you get hit with ATM fees that are a couple of bucks. Well, but just imagine, though, if you're a city, instead of being nickel and dimed, these things are all multiplied by millions of dollars. And that's money that could be spent on public services, especially when we're looking at situations where we're facing record deficits across the country. And there's a huge push around austerity, the need for shared sacrifice. The one place that we're never cutting, the one party that's never sacrificing, is the banks that are still charging the same fees they always have. In fact, in some cases, they've actually raised their fees.
And you mentioned the austerity measures that cities are going through. They're forced to essentially do more with less because they're getting less money from state governments, from federal governments. So why aren't more public officials acknowledging this?
It's just not the way that we're trained to think about these things in the public, in the finance world, right? The issue is that when you look at a public budget, the things are divided between discretionary spending and mandatory spending. Financial fees are considered mandatory. The services that people all rely on are considered, in budget speak, they're considered discretionary. So when it comes to public officials, often they're just not wired to think that way, that these things actually could be negotiated. They'll say, oh, well, we're paying the market rates. But then there's also a couple of other issues. Like, you do have a big revolving door between public finance jobs and Wall Street jobs. You also have cozy relationships that exist between public officials and the banks that they do business with, because they have they keep going back to the same folks over and over again for the business. And so they do get to know each other, and they do develop a rapport with them. And so all those things contribute.
And that goes to a line that I really like in your piece, where you say that market rates aren't preordained by God, because we do act like the market is this untouchable force. We don't acknowledge that the government has a role to play in the economy and the government. So do you think we have to have a culture shift before anything can be done?
Yeah, I think that is a real big issue, is that we are trained to think that the market is what the market is. And in actuality, and when it comes to municipal finance in particular, but really most of finance at this point, what we have is an oligopoly. It's not a free market. But it's also rigged in a very direct way, which is that a lot of the banks have actually paid billions in fees for illegally rigging rates. They've also paid, they've paid huge settlement fines for rigging bids on different types of derivative deals with municipalities. Several have actually pleaded guilty to criminal antitrust violations. So it's not just that they happen to be charging the same high rate, and so that's they're in effect rigging the rates. They actually have also, in addition to that, been caught breaking the law. Yeah, we still don't question these rates. We still assume that what they're charging us is what they should be charging us. And yeah, we absolutely need a culture shift around that.
So you suggest that cities should take a cue from the labor movement and institute some collective bargaining around these sorts of fees. What would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, one of the key things is that, in 2012, the city of Oakland launched a boycott of Goldman Sachs because Goldman Sachs would not renegotiate one of their interest rate swap deals that was costing the city $4 million a year. And, it was a great moment when the city of Oakland decided to do this. But the fact is that Oakland doesn't do that much business with Goldman in the first place. And Goldman, at the end of the day, kind of shrugged it off. But if you actually had a lot of cities join forces, then they could actually force the banks to actually care. So in the article, I pointed out that if you take the city of Chicago, New York City, the city of Los Angeles, together, they have about $600 billion of potential business that they do with Wall Street every year. If those three cities, for instance, were to pool their resources and say, actually, here are the terms that we want. If you don't want to do business with us, then hit the road. We'll find someone else. Well, they could actually force the banks to bend to them. And what we need is for cities and states to actually start using their collective bargaining power as customers of Wall Street to force them to do better. That if Wall Street may not have a moral compass in how they approach municipal finance, and their top goal with every interaction is just to extract as much money as they can so they can pad their profits. But cities can actually bring the moral element into their relationship by saying, actually, we have a moral compass, and if you want to abide by the rules that we're setting, then we'll find someone who will. And they will find someone who will, because the fact is that there's money to be made there.
We got a nod from my producer, because I'm from Oakland and I'm constantly bragging about how we do things right out there. So I'm glad that you brought up that example. But not every city has the kind of activist tradition that we do in the Bay Area, where we, I think, are predisposed to want to push back against big banks. So, what kind of mechanism or force can really, I guess, push other cities to take similar steps? Because what you're proposing sounds like a really good idea, but the idea of getting these cities coordinated to do this seems like a huge task.
Yeah, I mean, you really need a people's movement calling on this, right? So even in Oakland, the fact is that it took us a long time to get the resolution passed. And when it passed, it was over the objections of a lot of the city's financial staff, because it was, very much pushing back on the relationships that the city had. And so even there, where you have this activist tradition, the only reason why it got passed was because you actually had this, group that came together under the banner of the Coalition to Stop Goldman Sachs, that basically packed the room at like three or four straight city council meetings and, in effect, hijacked the meeting, right? They basically, in Oakland, they have public comment before the normal business of the city council starts. And so there was this meeting that took place in the spring of 2012, where I think for like 3 or 4 hours, it was just public comments about why are we giving all this money away to Goldman Sachs before the city council could talk about any of their other business. And so it really was that there was this big people's movement that actually forced the city to take on this issue. And what we need is for other cities to start doing to start doing this as well. So what's been promising is in LA last year, we actually, there was a resolution that got passed by the city council over there to try to challenge bank fees and try to negotiate better deals, where we've started to see some movement from other city officials in some cases, city or state pension fund officials as well, that are starting to sort of do reports looking at fees. And so there's some movement of the right steps, but what it's really going to take to be able to take this more into the mainstream is if we can actually get a lot of people, you know, out there looking at all the issues that they're facing in their daily lives, looking at all the cuts that are being proposed, if they can actually start talking about, you know, connecting this back to and who's profiting off of it, and really sort of turning up the street heat around that to put pressure on their elected officials.
So another city that I love is Detroit. I actually just got back from there, and you wrote a piece earlier this summer called Why Chicago Won't Go Bankrupt and Detroit Didn't Have to. And you wrote that austerity hawks are now hoping to use the Detroit playbook in other cities to force the public to accept extreme measures to fix budget crises. You know, how can we, as activists, as policymakers, you know, our listeners, how can we push back against these kind of false austerity calls?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting about Detroit, well, there's so many things that are interesting about Detroit, but the thing that I really touched on in my article was that bankruptcy there was not just a matter of fact. It was a choice that was made by city officials and by state officials, really, more than city officials, to push the city into bankruptcy. And when we look at financial crises that we're facing in cities across the country, this isn't just something that happened. The crises that we're facing are the result of decisions that have been made by city, state officials to not force big corporations, the rich Wall Street banks, to pay their fair share. And so the thing is that, you know, in Detroit, what we saw was that, yes, the city had some real structural, you know, long-term structural economic issues. But in the immediate term, the bankruptcy itself was caused by a series of decisions that were made in order to push a different agenda. Basically, the governor came in, and Governor Rick Snyder came in 2010, or he was elected in 2010, came in 2011. And he had an agenda. Among other things, he wanted to, you know, slash pensions in Detroit. He wanted to regionalize or privatize the water system, and he wanted to hollow out the political power of the largely African-American city in Detroit, which was where a lot of the progressive base in the city actually in the state actually resides in that city. And he wanted to undermine that. And so for him, bankruptcy was actually, in some ways, it was a foregone conclusion. It wasn't like there was a problem he was trying to solve and bankruptcy was a solution. It was that he knew that he wanted to bankrupt the city in order to achieve other ends. And that's what he did. And too often, austerity is sort of pitched to us as a necessity. It's never a necessity. It is always a choice, because it is a choice to force the people who can least afford it to shoulder the burden of paying to fix the crisis that has been created by people who are not paying their fair share. And so that's the key thing that I think the key lesson to draw from Detroit really is that we shouldn't let what happened to Detroit happen to other places. We should let the Detroit bankruptcy be a cautionary tale.
Our guest is Saka Bhatti, director of the Refund America Project. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me is Clara Miller, president of the F.B. Heron Foundation in New York City. It's a private foundation dedicated to helping low-income people and communities. Clara Miller, thank you so much for joining the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Clara, just to start, there's actually a really interesting article that you wrote about how the economy has changed and how poverty is now structural, not marginal, as you put it. And you make the case that because of this change that we've seen in the economy, that, quote, business as usual is no longer an option for philanthropic foundations like yours. What do you mean by this exactly?
Well, I guess it'd be helpful to know what I'm defining business as usual as. And most foundations, not everybody knows this, but private foundations typically invest a large sum of money, usually very large, given by a private donor, wealthy, generous, wealthy individual, invest that conventionally, and then 5% of that by law is spent every year on typically grants to nonprofit organizations to do do their wonderful work, whatever it is. Our mission is an anti-poverty one, but others have other missions. And our view, we basically said, well, we can't afford to pretend that marginal solutions, meaning, you know, these kind of grants to nonprofits who are meant to be the auxiliary that helps clean up after flaws in the economy, is enough to actually do the job. That the economy we have to stanch the flow of problems that are coming to the nonprofit sector. We can't just, you know, the nonprofit world is not meant to be a scaled part of solving problems. It's actually meant to be an auxiliary. So we said, why don't we just look at every asset we have as part of the solution rather than just that 5%. And that's been the case at the foundation for a number of years, and we've just accelerated that trend recently.
And so one way that what you've just talked about has been described is that your foundation decided to go all in.
That's right, exactly. We said, look, the problems, you know, the poverty is systemic, problems are geographically unbounded, they're multi-sector. We need everybody in the game. We can't pretend that we can solve this without, you know, muscular big public companies and private equity and all sorts of things. Why not use those tools? Those are tools of philanthropy. And philanthropy for us is a way of life. It's not just grant making. It's changing the way we live our lives and do business.
Well, and so one of the main thing that really characterizes going all in for you guys is that you've moved 100% of the foundation's endowment into what are sometimes called impact investments. What are impact investments, and what does this really mean in practical terms?
Well, of course, like everything in the world, there are a lot of different points of view on what impact investments are. And Heron, I mean, we kind of mischievously say, we think all investments are impact investments. It's just that people aren't aware whether the impact is good or bad on society or on the economy in general, on the people we care about in poverty. So what we started with is saying, let's examine our portfolio and see if a company is actually providing decent jobs to people, or are they growing in a way that doesn't demand that they're super extractive of natural resources and labor. And so that's the point of view we take. And we think as a philanthropic institution, it's part of our fiduciary duty to of obedience to mission to make sure that all our assets actually contribute to the common good.
Can you give us an example of an impact investment like you were just describing?
Well, so one would be we've made a private equity investment in a private equity firm that is focused on doing environmentally, socially positive company investments and working with companies to make sure that that's the way they run their businesses. And so in one of those, for example, we've invested it through a private equity firm in a group of portfolio companies that now employ more than 800 people and has created over 7,000 jobs. And 80% of those have most of their employees as part owners of the work, and the work pays a living wage. So to us, you know, we can do both, and we can invest in good companies that are providing good jobs, and we can also make grants to nonprofit organizations that are doing wonderful work. But that's an example of one that's in our endowment.
Well, I mean, to hear you describe it, it sort of sounds like this is a no-brainer, right? This is really kind of a win-win. Why is this such a radical idea, and why are so many foundations resistant to this approach?
I think it's a dumb moment too. I really don't know. I think it's like everything. It's habit, it's culture, it's the investment community stands to gain, the way foundations were originally created. It sometimes meant that they were there's a kind of what some actually describe as a separation of church and state. The whole business model is separated into one side does good grant making and the other side basically runs an investment fund. And they don't interact. It's kind of like, it's hard enough to make 5.5% real over here on the investment side. You stay out of our business and we'll fund your grant. And that's very typical. And it's starting to change very slowly, but it's complicated, and especially for the larger foundations, I think. But I don't really know why it has not been something obvious. I mean, people have actually said, "Well, isn't that what they all?" You know, I've told them about what Heron does, and they say, "But isn't that what foundations do?" And I said, "Well, not really."
So in addition to going all in, are there other changes that you have made as you've tried to adapt to the new economy? Maybe have there been any changes in the kinds of grants that you've been making to organizations that are trying to fight poverty?
Right. We have basically chosen a specific financial role, which most foundations make grants and they don't think of them as either being capital grants specifically or essentially purchasing services kinds of grants. They're just grants. And we've said we're going to be a capital investor, which means when we put money into an organization, we want to see it change or grow. And that's for nonprofits as well as for-profits or cooperatives or, you know, whatever it might be. So when we make a grant to a nonprofit, that nonprofit has a real opportunity to grow that will result in having a really positive impact on the people we want to help. And that means for us that those grants are bigger and that they're made on the basis of growth that is sustainable and attracts revenue to those organizations rather than replacing it. And that takes some time and analysis. But it also means, from the point of view of Heron, that we now make grants that are more like $1.5 million on average, as opposed to $75,000 on average, which has been a huge change. But those $1.5 million grants are typically part of a much bigger campaign of, you know, $5 to $20 million. To fund the growth of an organization in exactly the way a private equity firm's growth would be funded through its general partners and investors.
And one last question for you. I'm going to zoom out a little bit and ask you the $65,000 or maybe the $1.5 million question, right?
Yeah.
What do you view as the role of philanthropy in fighting poverty and inequality?
So that's a huge one. I mean, there's been a really interesting, distinguished history on the part of many foundations in, for example, the civil rights movement. A group of foundations made early grants and faithful grants to civil rights organizations back in the 50s and 60s. Recently, the gay marriage movement, there have been, you know, the Haas Jr. Foundation and the Gill Foundation, both were very instrumental in those movements. So there's a kind of a funding of movements, which is very important. We're taking a very an enterprise finance lens, because we're saying we want to find enterprises that employ people with decent living wage jobs or advocate on their behalf. and strengthen those enterprises so they can do their great work. So that's a little bit different approach. So there's many, and I think diversity is really good. So I would say we have one approach, but there's many other foundations that are doing a different kettle of fish, and I'm sure I'm leaving some approaches out.
Clara Miller, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, and we look forward to having you back at some point in the future to talk about the experience and success that you have from going all in.
Oh, that'd be great. It's been a real pleasure.
Clara Miller is president of the F.B. Heron Foundation in New York City. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast.
You can also find us on the Progressive Voices Network at 10 a.m. East, 7 a.m. West, using the TuneIn app.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford 'cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time...